From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A strong dose of wanderlust on today's Fresh Air, courtesy of my guest, travel writer Paul Theroux. His new book, Riding the Red Rooster, is an account of his trip across China by rail. Also today, I speak with writer Barbara Garson. Her new book, The Electronic Sweatshop, examines how workers are monitored by computers on the job. Computers may be surrogate bosses, but language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says they have a long way to go before they can talk like people. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of works by Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. There's a Chinese proverb that says, "We can always fool a foreigner." Writer Paul Theroux took that as a personal challenge during his recent year-long train trip through China. That journey is the subject of his new book, Riding the Iron Rooster. Theroux is a highly regarded travel writer who has chronicled his journeys to places as remote as the southernmost point of South America and as close to home as the New York subway system. His first travel book, The Great Railway Bazaar, was a bestseller. Theroux is also a novelist. Two of his novels, St. Jack and The Mosquito Coast, have been adapted into movies. When he's not traveling, Theroux divides his time between homes in England and Cape Cod. He's American-born. In his new book, Theroux explains that he decided to go by train from London to China. He thought it would be relaxing. It wasn't. But he says it was his good fortune to be wrong. Being mistaken is the essence of the traveler's tale. He told me why.
Because the unexpected has to happen in order for a traveler's tale to be effective and interesting and worth telling. I think that it's only the extraordinary, the unlikely, the unexpected that's worth writing about in travel. And if you notice, all good travel books and all good trips are good because they're not what you expect. And it's the reason why from there really isn't much to say about the package tour or if I had simply gone to the Great Wall, to Peking, Shanghai and Canton, there really wouldn't have been a book about China that was possible. It was only because I went, I suppose, to extremes and went to such a lot of trouble to inconvenience myself that there was something worth telling.
So is that part of what makes a travel book good too, that the traveler puts themselves through extremes?
I think that you have to offer yourself to conditions. You might travel with a theme, but there are a lot of things that can happen. The main thing is that with travel, travel writing is a very debased form, and it's a very, very insufficient form, so that travel writing can be autobiography, or it can be like a geography book, or it could be somewhere in the middle where you're writing a little bit about yourself and about other people. I think basically travel writing, it should be about other people, but inevitably autobiography gets into it.
Why did you want to return to China?
I wanted to go back because I felt that China was changing, and all countries that are in a process of change, transition, or any alteration, for example, when there's a coup d'etat or when there's a presidential election or when something goes badly wrong or when they strike oil, then countries become interesting to write about. I mean, I don't find countries particularly interesting when they're moribund and changeless. But when there are events, great events, public events, let's say, then they become interesting. I wrote about England during the Falklands War, and I couldn't have chosen a better time. I mean, it was accidental, but it was the best time to write about England. I was in Argentina during the time of the colonels. That was interesting. China after Mao, and now with the Chinese admitting that Mao is rather ambiguous and unpleasant figure for part of his life, has made the China interesting. And also, the Chinese are very candid. They're outward looking now. Their economy has changed, and I mean nothing is more interesting than to travel sort of far and or to range far and wide in a place where these things are happening. Then you have a real subject.
Did you run into a lot of other writers with the same idea that this is like the perfect time to catch up on what's happening in China?
I didn't run into any writers. I didn't meet people who were traveling for the purposes of writing. There are a lot of books about China, but they tend to be political books or analytical books or journeys of self-discovery. I wanted to write a book about what China looks like, what it smells like, what the food's like, what the landscape's like, what, you know, the physical China, not the political China. But inevitably, I mean, some politics gets into it, but I don't think of my book as political in any sense.
One of your goals was to get to China without leaving the ground, to go from England to China without leaving the ground.
Yeah.
Is that because you wanted to do something challenging or because you really don't like planes?
I don't particularly. There's nothing to like in planes. I mean, there's a lot to dislike, but a plane is really just sort of time travel. You get in, you strap yourself in, you go, and there's nothing interesting about it. I mean, compare flying to China, which takes about, let's say it takes 15 hours from London to Peking. Compare that with a month overland by train where you go to Paris, Berlin, East and West Berlin, Warsaw, Moscow, and then along the Trans-Siberian through Siberia and then through Mongolia. I mean, after that, at the end of it, China, you've arrived at the end of this long trip and have seen a lot and have seen Asia begin and Asia continue and then China begin. It's not like plunging in the middle of China, and then you know, from Long Island or Philadelphia, and then sort of that travelogue starting. This is China arriving or Asia beginning by degrees, and that's the way to understand a country, because a country doesn't begin abruptly at its border. It spills over its border, it spills over its frontier, and there's a lot of China in Mongolia. There's a lot of China, or let's say Asia, in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is an Asian country. Or at least half of it is. So it was worth it going by overland. And that's the way the Chinese travel. So, I mean, when the Chinese leave China, they try to take the train to Paris.
You've certainly been on a lot of very long train rides in your time. One thing I like about trains is that life is on hold in a way. You can't get any phone calls. There's no big decisions to make. You're on the train reading a book or talking to people, eating, whatever. Do you like train rides? And if so, what do you like about them?
I think that I like them in countries where people travel by train. I don't think I'd enjoy being in a country. Well, say, I have mixed feelings about traveling by train in the States. I do it. And the Northeast Corridor, it's a quick way of getting from place to place, and a lot of people do it. But you don't understand the United States by taking trains. I think in countries like India, the Soviet Union, and China, and even places like Holland, where there are a lot of trains, you are traveling the way the people in the country are traveling, and seeing it with them, and watching them at work, or you say that life is on hold. I don't think life is on hold on a train.
On an Amtrak, it is.
On an Amtrak, but in most countries, life continues on a train the way it was. Let's say at their houses. I mean, people take food on, they take their children, they eat, they sleep, they make love, they have arguments, they live, they die. I mean, I was on a train where in the Soviet Union, where a man died. People presumably have given birth on trains. Life isn't on hold. Mm-hmm. And you're sleeping horizontally, you're walking around, there's a dining car. It's more like an ocean liner. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that it's divorced, it seems to be divorced from the life of the land, but also life continues, and one of its pleasures is that life continues. I think life is on hold in a plane where you're simply holding your breath and waiting to arrive and waiting for the travel to begin. And inevitably, people have to do that to get places. I mean, I travel by plane all the time. I don't cross the Atlantic in a boat. But I think the train is a very revealing way of going about it, and traveling in China by train, probably the most revealing way of all of going from place to place. Also, the Chinese don't check on train travelers the way they check on other people. If you go to an airport, I mean, they expect foreigners will be going into airports and going through customs and showing visas and passports and so forth. But slipping on and off a train is a very, very good anonymous way of rambling around China without being checked up on.
My guest is writer Paul Theroux, who's written several novels and many travel books as well. His new book is titled Riding the Iron Rooster, and it's about his train journey through China. Now, to get to China by train, you ended up signing yourself onto one of these package tours where you travel with a group of people, and this is a very unusual thing for you to do. You're usually the the lonesome traveler, going by yourself someplace.
Yes.
And you seemed very unhappy traveling with a group of people who felt to you like distant relatives to whom you had very little to say. Why did you do it?
I wanted to see... I wasn't very unhappy. I was... I couldn't be myself. That's a problem, you know, of being... I had to be a quiet and unassuming little person and watching. And I found that... I'm not. I'm a talkative and rather gregarious person.
We didn't have to do that. No one was forcing you to do that. I mean, to be unassuming and quiet.
I wanted to listen. I wanted to hear what people were saying. I wanted them to do the talking. And, I mean, inevitably that happens in travel, but these were all English-speaking people. And so, also, they expect you to come clean and to tell you about themselves. And as soon as a writer starts talking, when he says that he is a writer, then suddenly the conversation becomes, I mean, it turns over to him or to her, and that's the, and then people are just asking questions. Have your books been made into movies? What's it like to write? Do you write with a pencil? And you might be in an interesting place, like Siberia, or they might have had interesting experience, and suddenly they're not interesting, you're interesting. And I know that other people are much more interesting than I am. I also went on this tour because I wanted to know who's going to China these days. Why are they going? Where are they coming from? What are they going to do there? What do they expect it to be? What's their reaction to Poland? What's their reaction to the Soviet Union? I mean, Americans are so paranoid about the Soviet Union. They're so pathetically sort of affectionate about the Poles. They're so fearful of, say, the East Germans. They feel so sort of inferior, let's say, to the French. I mean, the French are just the French, and the Poles are just the Poles. But we have these national prejudices against countries which have been, I suppose, foisted upon us by newspapers or by movies or something. And I was interested to see people's reactions, and then also to see, I mean, it's amazing with a Chinese smile at the traveler, how people melt, and they say, my God, they're smiling, and the streets are so clean. It's the simplest reactions can, or the simplest gestures can provoke reactions. Now, that's, if you're going to China with a group of people, all of those things are interesting. I learned a lot of things that I didn't know before. I mean, I didn't know that people went on package tours for shopping.
Right, yeah, you said that that's what Americans do when they travel, they just shop.
A lot of people go, I mean, not just Americans, but they go to China to shop, yeah. They go to Hong Kong to shop.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting? You said that on the train rides that a lot of the people on the tour spoke to each other like they were hospital patients.
Yeah, that's true. That's people who are enclosed start asking each other about, you know, have you had a good night's sleep? And did you eat much? And I didn't have much for breakfast. And are you feeling all right? Well, I got a little back problem. And yes, but I seem to be, you know, my stomach's okay again today. And they are, they're sort of creaking around. But these are people, you know, middle-aged people who aren't at death's door. But they start, when you're alone in an enclosed space, you start thinking about your health. Am I dying? Am I sick? Am I healthy? And people on package tours are always asking, am I healthy? Have I got hepatitis? Am I going to get, you know, Montezuma's revenge or whatever? And so, that's pretty interesting, or boring as the case may be.
Well, once you got to China and you were off the package tour, you ended up eventually being assigned a traveling companion. How did that happen? And who assigned the companion to you?
Well, the Chinese got wind of the fact that I was a writer, and then began saying that they wanted to give me VIP treatment. I said I didn't really want it, but they insisted, such is their fear that you might misunderstand something, that I travel with a man. I said, yes, I'll travel with him, but I don't want to sit with him. I don't want to give him English lessons. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to eat with him. But I'll travel. I said, if he travels on a different part of the train. And he said, well, he'll carry your bags. I said, here's this Mr. Fang. He's got a father of two. He went to a university. Why do you want him to carry my bags? This is ridiculous. You know, he's a member of the proletariat. So am I. Why should he be carrying? So they got the point, actually. Inevitably, I grew to like this man very much. And he told me about his sufferings in the Cultural Revolution. He was a Russian scholar. They sent me with a person who didn't speak English because I said, I'm not going to talk to him, so it doesn't matter whether he speaks English or not. But we did converse in China. I speak Chinese, so that wasn't much of a problem. And I got to like him. But I didn't travel with him the whole time. After a month or so, I found a way of giving him the slip. and I was just as happy. And he went back thinking that I wasn't in China anymore. And then I was on my own.
You noticed a lot of changes in China from your previous trip. What about the way you were treated? Were you reacted to differently this time around than you were in 1980 when you first went to China?
Yes, I was, but not because of, you know, I'm a bespectacled American asking a lot of questions. I think it was mainly to do with the Chinese. I mean, I hadn't changed. They had, though.
That's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah, that they had felt a lot less pressure to conceal things. Mm-hmm. The Chinese have started to become very honest about the past, the recent past, and particularly about the Cultural Revolution or about Chairman Mao or about Lin Biao and what they call the Gang of Four. And they're starting to tell, well, I don't know, I suppose starting to tell the truth. Before, they were avoiding a subject. If you said Chairman Mao was a great man, they'd say, ah, interesting, you think so, huh? You think so. They never said, no, we don't think he's great, or yes, he did a lot of great things, but it made a lot of mistakes. Now they say, yes, he was great up to 1957. Then he began to have witch hunts. Then he provoked the worst and most disastrous and catastrophic 10 years that the Chinese have had to endure in their history, the Cultural Revolution, and we won't forgive him for that. But they talk to strangers. They tell the truth. And, you know, it's officially forbidden for the Chinese to talk to strangers. This is why people have guides. The Chinese are not supposed to, and you're not supposed to talk to the Chinese, you know, impromptu. Just stop someone on the street and say, and hold a conversation. It's forbidden. Mm-hmm. It's just one of the rules, like a religious person cannot be a member of the Communist Party, or in the marriage law it says you must not kill your children. And talking to foreigners is just something that's not done. But they do it.
Well, I want to talk with you more about China and about travel, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Paul Theroux, whose new book is titled Riding the Iron Rooster by Train Through China. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Paul Theroux is my guest. You know, your trip through China ended in Tibet, or at least that's where your book ends up. And your book ends with you thinking how much you'd like to eventually get back to Tibet. It's interesting to me that in most travel books, I think, no matter how arduous the journey, no matter how many unexpected complexities and difficulties arise, that frequently the book ends with, gosh, I can't wait to get back. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, but there are plenty of books that aren't like that.
Well, of yours, for instance, like the old Patagonian Express.
Yes, I was quite eager to go back. There is a book called The Worst Journey in the World by Apsley Cherry Garrard, where he said I wouldn't go back if, you know, wild horses couldn't get me back to the South Pole, where he almost died. Wilfred Thesiger's books are not about wanting to go back. But I really did and do want to go back to the parts of China that I liked and to a couple of parts that I wasn't able to go. I mean, some places are off limits. But Tibet was one of them. The Qinghai Desert and Amdo and Tibet, and particularly Western Tibet. I think that I've never seen a place more beautiful, more unexpected, or harder to find comparison with in the rest of the world. The air is different, the light's different. Even the mountains, I mean, they're not just the bare, craggy peaks that you see in the Alps or the Rockies or the Andes. It's a totally different place. An early traveler to Tibet, Sven Hayden, burst into tears when he first saw the mountains. And I didn't, but I can understand how he felt, how looking at the place, you just see nothing like it on Earth. And it's a place apart.
When your trip ends, and you realize I've come to the destination that I've planned, do you try to get home as quickly as possible? Like take that plane instead of taking the long, you know, slowly unfolding train journey back?
No, I hurry home when a trip is over. But for lots of reasons. I mean, I have a wife and two children. I have bills to pay. I have, you know, things. My life is sort of on hold in a way if I'm traveling. Imagine not getting your mail for 3, 4, 5, or 6 months, and the amount of pestering letters or demands or unanswered questions there are, you really have to go back. I find I have to go back quickly. So I think go slowly, come back quickly. It's like a dance step, isn't it? Like a tango or something. But that's what I do. And when I left China, I went to Tibet very slowly. I took the train from Xi'an to Xining, and then Xining to Golmud in the middle of Qinghai province, which is a very, very empty province. It's a prison province where they send, it's a sort of Siberia where they send really, you know, political prisoners. And they, throughout Chinese history, they've exiled people there. So it's really at the back of beyond. Then I went by road. I rented a car and a driver, and then the driver got us into an accident, so I ended up driving to Lhasa. But that was a very slow, long, interesting trip. But I remember when I left Lhasa, I went straight home. I flew to Hong Kong and went straight back.
Have you ever gone back to the place where you grew up? And I'm not sure where that is.
I grew up in Medford, Massachusetts.
Okay, have you ever gone back there with the eye of a travel writer to look at the place with fresh eyes as if you'd never seen it before?
Yes, I've even written about it. Oh. I wrote a piece there's a book called that I wrote, a book of essays called Sunrise with Sea Monsters. It's 50 essays, and one of those is called Traveling Home, and it's about my high school reunion, where I went back to the town that I grew up in, Medford, Mass., and went back to my 20th high school reunion, which was one of the most interesting experiences of travel, and also of traveling through time as well as in space, of going back and seeing these people. I did it earlier this year in going back to the place that I was in the Peace Corps with 25 years ago. In 63, I went to Nyasaland, which later became Malawi. I was in the Peace Corps. And I went back to my old school there. I'm going to make another visit, and then I'm going to write about it. But that also was, I mean, going back is a wonderful thing. But you have to leave a lot of time, 10, 15, 20, ideally 20 years, I think. But 25 years in the case of Malawi was amazing. And I think that it will be enjoyable to write about, but it's difficult to write about because you're writing about looking down the years as well as sort of looking at a particular place. And in the case of Africa, I mean, so much has happened, and also a great deal hasn't happened.
Since you brought up your Peace Corps experience, I was, you know, reading about that and read somewhere that the first time you heard a Beatles record, it was in a bar in Africa.
And yeah, that's a fact.
And it made me think about how, since you started traveling when you were so young, that you experienced some of the big cultural landmarks of your generation away from home and away from other people from your culture.
Yes, I mean, the first marijuana I smoked was also in the Peace Corps in Malawi. First Beatles, first marijuana, and I got married, actually, in Uganda. I mean, my wife is English, so a lot of things happened to me. I mean, as a result of leaving home, I had felt all my life, all my early life, that nothing would have happened to me if I didn't leave home, and that it was necessary for me to go very, very far away for me to realize what I wanted to be. And I mean, I think I was right. If I had stayed in Medford, it would have been very much more difficult to become a writer, because people didn't become writers in Medford. They stayed in Medford and did other things. But in order to be myself, I had to go quite far. Joining the Peace Corps was only one of the strategies that I had, but there were others.
Well, no, did you have to get far away from home because other people, like you said, didn't become writers there, or because you felt that other people, your family and friends, wouldn't let you become who you wanted to be?
Well, I think it's partly that, but you can't really blame other people. I think it was my fault that I didn't have the courage, because at the age of 18 or 19, it's hard to have the courage to say, I want to be a writer, or I'm going to be a writer, because the proof is like saying, I want to be a dancer or an actor or a movie director. There are certain things that you can't say to people. You can't say, I'm going to be, I mean, you can't say, I'm going to be a radio presenter or a radio broadcaster, can you? Because where's your radio? Where's your microphone? In the case of a writer, they'd say, well, what are you going to write? People, I mean, I must have tried the question on people. I was very shy about admitting that I wanted to be a writer. And it was only through travel that I was able to see to tell perfect strangers that I wanted to be a writer. And they'd say, oh, yes, because some people understood that. And then it seemed that as if I had something to write about. But, I mean, I'm not blaming the people in Medford, Mass.
Right,
It's growing up is very, very difficult. But I think you become extremely self-conscious. And the convention at the time was that people became dentists, doctors, lawyers, or they went to Vietnam and got killed, which was another alternative that I was trying to avoid.
Since you've traveled to so many places, does home ever seem like an arbitrary decision? Like, why am I living here as opposed to another country or as opposed to another block or another city?
No, oddly enough, I really feel that I belong to the eastern part of Massachusetts. And, I mean, I live on Cape Cod for about half the year. It's something that what you just said is something I've never felt. I've never felt that I could attach myself to another culture or another country. I've lived in England for quite a long time. I feel like a total alien there. And it surprises me that Japanese, Nigerians, Hindus, Pakistanis, Afghans, Russians come to the United States and say, I'm an American. How can people do that? I mean, they're leaving so much behind. I know that there's a necessity, or in history there's been a necessity for people to do that. But they must have this tremendous longing to go back at times. They must have a homing instinct. There must be I think of all new Americans as homesick people. Or maybe they're like people who are drowning, who are in a kind of lifeboat, and the lifeboat's flying the stars and stripes, but still they're leaving something behind. And it's something that I could never do, perhaps because I'm an American, and Americans don't transplant very easily. You don't find Americans who become Indians. The Japanese forbid any foreigner from becoming Japanese. So other people don't do it. But in other words, I have a very strong sense of home. And I think it's a strong sense of home that makes me a traveler. So I have a place to go back to. It's people who don't have a place to go back to who are aimless, and I think not particularly good travelers, because they're always looking for something to attach themselves to. They're looking for a country, a great good place, or somewhere to live. I'm not looking for a place to live. I'm just looking. And I think in a kind of impartial way.
Now that you've returned from a trip, are you planning another?
No, I'm writing a novel at the moment, and I think I'll... And I've been writing movie scripts with a lot of pleasure, so I'll wait a while. I think travel is an indulgence. I mean, it takes so long. It's a lot of trouble. My family misses me. I miss them. So I think I'll wait a while, maybe 2 or 3 years, and then there are a lot of parts of the world that I've never been. Then I'll probably pick up and do it. But the best travel is not writing about it. It's actually going to a place and going for a hike, going camping. Or in my case, I like kayaking. So I'd do something like that, I suppose.
This is what we civilians call a vacation.
I'm very fond of the phrase that psychologists use, deep play.
Right.
Where the risks far outweigh the gains.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
My guest has been writer Paul Theroux, and his new book is titled Riding the Iron Rooster by Train Through China. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Jeffrey O'Brien. His new book, Dreamtime, Chapters from the 60s, is a meditation on the social and political ferment of the decade. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Imagine a job where you're constantly watched, where the boss never blinks, where your slightest inefficiency is noticed and remembered. Writer Barbara Garson says those jobs exist now thanks to computer monitoring. Coming up, we discuss her new book, The Electronic Sweatshop. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz introduces us to the works of Arvo Pärt. He's an Estonian composer whose music is influenced by minimalism and medieval liturgical music. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the difficulties of making computers sound like people. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The fourth summit meeting between President Reagan and General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev is over. Both leaders held news conferences today to sum up the president's four-day visit to Moscow. Details from NPR's Ann Garrels.
The summit has produced no new major agreements on policy issues, but both Reagan and Gorbachev called this summit a victory for political realism. Verification issues on the draft strategic arms treaty remain unresolved, but Gorbachev said he believes this treaty can be completed this year. President Reagan would not set a deadline. In a two-hour press conference, Gorbachev detailed outstanding problems, disagreements on the U.S. Strategic Defense Initiative, U.S.-Soviet trade, and on President Reagan's efforts to improve Soviet human rights, Gorbachev said, quote, "I have no admiration for that part of the trip." At his press conference, President Reagan gave Gorbachev a large share of the credit for improved U.S.-Soviet relations and said he would tell his successor how warm and friendly the Soviet people are. After attending the Bolshoi Theater and a private dinner with the Gorbachevs tonight, President and Mrs. Reagan took an unscheduled late-night stroll in Red Square. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The fragile truce between First Ladies Nancy Reagan and Raisa Gorbachev appears to have broken down. They've resumed the contentious battle for press attention, which began at the Washington summit last December. Today, Mrs. Reagan angrily interrupted as Mrs. Gorbachev tried to stop reporters from asking questions. "I want to say something, okay?" Mrs. Reagan said. The Soviet First Lady backed off with a pointed glance at her watch. Later, during a tour of the Tretyakov Gallery, the president's wife complained that Mrs. Gorbachev ignored the religious significance of the icons held in the collection. Mrs. Reagan's news secretary explained the behavior, saying the two first ladies are from entirely different worlds. A new report from the National Academy of Sciences finds U.S. efforts to fight the AIDS epidemic are disorganized. Michael Richards has more.
The National Academy report finds government agencies sometimes act against each other in pursuing the fight against the AIDS epidemic. Theodore Cooper, who headed the panel compiling the report, says the country needs a permanent AIDS commission, one that will continue the work when the President's Commission on AIDS completes its report and goes out of business later this month.
Our committee is convinced that a disease which presents the imposing and complex problems of AIDS cannot be effectively attacked without a continuing national commission to provide leadership and direction spanning all components of the public and private sectors.
The National Academy of Sciences report also calls for more money and effort in caring for those with AIDS, in AIDS education and in AIDS research, as well as a federal law to protect the confidentiality of AIDS tests. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
The government said today its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.2% in April. The modest monthly increase is the third in a row. The Commerce Department uses the figure to predict economic growth, but former presidential economic advisor Alfred Kahn warns that the index is not the accurate forecasting tool it once was.
The leading indicators are not nearly so good an indicator as they have been in the past. They've been misleading us for quite a long time now. The economy has been surprisingly strong, much stronger than the leading indicators would seem to suggest.
In a separate report, the government said factory orders for manufactured goods shot up 1.2% in April. Experts say the figure indicates that industrial production will increase in the months ahead. And in a third report, the Commerce Department said construction spending rose 0.1% in April. A big increase in investment of new factories helped offset a decline in government construction projects. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 33 points to close at 2064.01. Advances led declines more than 4-1 in heavy trading of 234 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 49 cents. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a recording by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. The album's titled Arbos. Pärt left the Soviet Union with his family in 1980 and became an Austrian citizen. He now lives in Berlin. His music sounds similar to that of the minimalists, but Pärt has been especially influenced by medieval liturgical music.
I was driving home one night and listening to the car radio. The announcer was introducing the Stabat Mater by Arvo Pärt. I dimly recalled seeing his name on the stark but elegant jackets of a couple of ECM records. But I'd never heard a note, and taking the line of least resistance, I kept listening. I'm glad I did. What I heard was a piece of unearthly beauty, almost literally. It seemed otherworldly in its purity, in its spare means. Simple broken chords, slowly repeated over and over, yet without the steely calculation or worked-up energy of minimalism. Its deep sincerity got under my skin, like a kind of modern Gregorian chant. Pärt has said that, quote, "It is enough when a single note is beautifully played. This one note, or a silent beat, or a moment of silence, comfort me." Minimalism has never been this minimal. Pärt has written that he builds his music out of, quote, "the most primitive materials, with the triad, with one specific tonality. The three notes of the triad are like bells." He calls his method tintinnabulation. He composed the Stabat Mater in 1985. It's 25 minutes long and scored for a string trio and three very high voices, soprano, tenor, and countertenor. The performers on the recording are the well-known Russian violinist Gidon Kramer, a longtime champion of Pärt's music, violist Vladimir Mendelssohn, and cellist Thomas Demenga. The soprano is Lynn Dawson, and the two male voices belong to David James and Roger Covey Crump of the Hilliard Ensemble, a group best known for singing early music, but that has also worked extensively with Pärt. The Stabat Mater is a 13th century poem in which the poet prays to identify with the suffering of Mary at the foot of the cross, and Pärt's uncanny textures and out-of-the-cradle, endlessly rocking rhythms capture both its ecstasy and its deep poignance. Art has alternated between periods of high productivity and periods of introspection and withdrawal. In the 60s, he wrote primarily orchestral pieces and experimented with 12-tone music that aroused official criticism. Later, his style was transformed by his exposure to early church music. His best-known work is Tabula Rasa from 1977, and the ECM recording of that was a surprise bestseller. The seven pieces on this new album, Arbos, were composed between 1976 and 1986. The brief title cut, Arbos, represents to Pärt the image of a growing tree. It's a kind of ritual fanfare played by the brass ensemble of the Stuttgart Staatsorchester, and its celebratory sound world is something like Janáček's Sinfonietta. But it's the Stabat Mater, one of Pärt's three longest compositions, that is the jewel of this album. It guarantees Pärt his solitary place beside Josquin, Palestrina, Pergolesi, Haydn, Rossini, Dvorak, Liszt, and Verdi, other composers who were also moved to respond to these still moving words.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a recording by Arvo Pärt called Arbos. It's on the ECM label. This is Fresh Air. In the early 70s, Barbara Garson interviewed hundreds of factory workers about the little games they played to keep from going crazy on the job. That was the basis of her book, All the Livelong Day. The workplace has changed since then. Many factories have closed down. Now computers are altering working life on jobs ranging from fast food fry cook to stockbroker. Garson's new book is about how computers are transforming the office of the future into the factory of the past. I asked her to explain the book's title, The Electronic Sweatshop.
Those kinds of white-collar jobs that are monitored, where the computer controls you. And I had thought when I started that the electronic sweatshop was in back offices of the kind that I had worked in. And I find that it moves upscale, if you will, or up the career ladder, so that even a top stockbroker, a big Wall Street broker, will find that his job is so monitored that the company can pull out information about what he's doing every minute of the day.
I learned through your book that when you call an airline to make your reservations, that those calls are have become standardized calls, that there's a way of behaving for the person taking your call.
Yes, what's happening is the same thing that happened to industrial work a couple of centuries ago. Take a craftsman's job, someone who knew what he should do next, and break the work down into little pieces. Find out what he does, break it down into little pieces, and give him back as a sort of an assembly line task. Well, they've taken a human conversation that should last about 2.5 minutes, according to the airlines, and broken it down into more than a dozen parts, and the clerk you're talking with is graded for more than a dozen things while he's on the air with you, but that's why when you get off the phone and you say, God, I might as well be talking to an idiot, or I might as well be talking to a machine, chances are you soon will be.
How are the calls standardized? For instance, in airline reservations, What is it broken down to, and how is it supposed to proceed?
There's different ways. First, there's the numerical things he's graded on. He's graded on the total amount of time, the AHU, the after hang-up time, which is the time it takes him to enter your data after he hangs up, which is 17 seconds in Canada and 13 seconds at American Airlines. He's graded on not only the number of reservations he made, but the number of people who flew under his sign. It sounds like astrology, but the number who he finally booked. And then each conversation has its sections. He has an opening. He has a close. He's graded for things like use of name, like he's supposed to say, well, Miss Garson, would you like to fly on the 10 o'clock or the 4 o'clock? And he's graded on all those things. And you're trying to talk to him like a human being and say, well, I don't know, I'll have to call back my mother. And he's saying, well, would you like to take the 10 o'clock or the 4 o'clock? And you wonder why he's such a jerk.
Now, I recently made airline reservations, and I thought, gosh, they're not really hearing me because I'm not really ready to book. All I need now is information, and they keep booking me in. Like, what's what's going wrong?
Well, and the funny thing is I was at American Airlines at a point when they'd done a survey, and they found that their reservation agents were too pushy, were viewed as too pushy. So I thought, aha. They were retraining them. They'll just let them handle it how they want it, you know, let 100 flowers bloom. Well, no, they now recreated a less pushy conversation. I said, why don't you let them do it the way they wanted? But these electronic sweatshops, from airline reservation up to the conversations that that stockbrokers should have, the management goal is to pre-plan everything and to leave as few decisions to the person as possible.
How are phone calls and conversations monitored?
By two ways, and I'm glad you asked that, because most of the people that I've talked to so far are more offended by the idea of listening in. You know, eavesdropping, big brother. That has a kind of a splashy sound. But the kind of electronic monitoring that really worries me sounds less worrisome at first. I was working on a data entry clerk, and it didn't seem to be any supervisors in the office. And somebody called me aside after a couple of nights. I couldn't understand why none of the women were talking and gossiping together. And somebody calls me aside and says, as a matter of fact, called me down four flights, and he pressed a few, like, chords from his machine. And he said, gee, your keystroke count fell to under 9,000 an hour after dinner two nights in a row. Now, that kind of monitoring, that he could tell every second that I stopped to scratch my nose, I have a great deal of difficulty getting liberal people who are worried about the monitoring of their calls, or who are worried about the collection of data about their credit ratings or their doctors. They say to me, well, but that's not privacy. They don't understand the pressure you're under when the motions of your hands and almost the motions of your brains are continuously recorded.
You bring up an interesting paradox in your book. Many of us thought that when word processors entered the workplace, that secretaries would be freed up to do more diverse work because they wouldn't have to be retyping things. They could fix errors very easily through the word processor and just print it out.
I love my word processor at home.
But what you found was that, in fact, for a lot of secretaries, they've been put into secretarial pools with word processors, and they just can't do anything except type all day.
Well, when IBM first started selling, they didn't have PCs, when they were selling these big word processors, IBM was trying to teach the companies that it sold to that they had to break the one-to-one relationship between secretary and boss. In other words, rather than just put the word processor on the secretary's desk and she'll save a good deal of time retyping, IBM suggested that, how do you know what the boss and secretary are doing with that saved time? If you, on the other hand, put them in pools, then you can begin to start time studying not only the secretary, but the manager. And that, by the way, was the key. Both IBM and Xerox acknowledged to me that cutting middle management time and beginning to time study middle management was a more important goal than time studying the secretary.
Do you think that unions today are addressing the kinds of issues that you bring up in your new book?
Oh, no. I'm sorry to say that. They're so beleaguered, they can barely keep up with it. I had to go to Canada, really, to do the Canadian Airlines story, to get a union that was able to explain to its members the difference between, you know, monitoring statistically and this individual monitoring.
After writing the electronic sweatshop, are you behaving any differently as a consumer? And here's what I'm thinking. I, for instance, when I call airline reservations, I really want to get as much information as I can and, try to be friendly. since I'm asking for so much information because I want to get all the flights and what all the discounts are. Now it dawns on me I might be hurting that person's career because I'm slowing them down and they might be held accountable for how long it's taking me to book my airline reservation.
I feel about it, and I guess I'm always torn between whether the best thing to do is to put in a human word that shows I understand but slows them down but gives a little break to the day, or whether the best thing is to move along at the pace of the person who's got a computer in front of him and saying something like, is that a business or a residential? And you say, well, I don't know, my father died. You're trying to change an insurance policy. My father died, and I was on the store in the house, and I don't know. And you know that that person cannot proceed until they answer A or B. It's like, this is what kills me. I talk to these people. They are, you know, people are terrific. People are funny. The book would be very boring if I was writing about the systems instead of the people. And then the management's goal is to pre-think it, to assume everything that they can possibly know and get it and tell people exactly how to do their business in advance. And it just takes away all the advantage you get out of using, if you will, a human being.
Yeah, well, you know, with all this monitoring and standardization, it's almost as if there's a level of paranoia behind it. If I don't watch every move they make, if I don't count every stroke that they input, maybe they'll get away with something.
You know, it's interesting that you should say that, because the management, they believe in class war much more than the workers. They assume that nobody wants to do a good job and everybody's trying to get away with everything. For the most part, the managers were a lot more class conscious or had a class war sense of control that the workers didn't.
Barbara, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Barbara Garson's new book, The Electronic Sweatshop, is published by Simon & Schuster. She spoke to us from station KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
You have some summit stories for us?
We have several summit stories, and we have several summit-related stories. A story out of Moscow on the INF Treaty. It's finally official. All the approvals have been gotten, and it will go into effect after years of negotiations. Also from New York, we have a story on A Walk in the Woods. That's a play that's on Broadway now, which is based on an incident that took place during a low point in previous arms negotiations. And finally, some politics closer to home, a report on the Jesse Jackson campaign in California. Apparently, presidential candidate Jackson is now talking about the vice presidency.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Talking computers are no longer confined to the realms of science fiction and fantasy. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has these thoughts on this new technology.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
When the movie 2001 first came out, a lot of reviewers were quick to point out that the computer Hal was the only human character in the movie. What made Hal work, of course, was that uncanny voice of his. Not the voice of a machine, but the voice of a man who thought he was a machine, who imagined himself to be wholly rational and infallible. It was the voice of a madman, in short, and it articulated all our worst fears about what kinds of people computers might become. The talking computers are among us now, but we can rest assured they sound comfortingly like machines. I've been fooling around lately with a little program called Smooth Talker that's made by a Southern California outfit called First Byte. Smooth Talker performs what's called text-to-speech synthesis on a home computer like a Macintosh. You enter some written text, and the program reads it back to you. The system doesn't use any pre-recorded sound. It actually builds up the voice digitally. Here's what it sounds like.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Okay, it's clear that this system is not about to put Alistair Cook out of a job. Right now, these simple text-to-speech systems are being applied to much more mundane tasks. For example, that make computers accessible to the blind. And they have the potential to revolutionize the teaching of writing and reading once a student can enter a text and hear it read back immediately.
How I spent my summer vacation. Billy and me went fishing. I caught a trout, but it got away.
Systems like these are instructive for two reasons. It's impressive to see what they can do, and instructive to learn what they can't. Their accomplishments are considerable. For example, Smooth Talker does a pretty good job with the notoriously difficult problems of English spelling. Listen to it read the sentence, "The heart of the bear is near the earth."
The heart of the bear is near the earth.
That's not bad when you consider that the letters E-A-R have four different pronunciations in the four words heart, bear, near, and earth. Then, too, the program is capable of changing its intonation. The trouble is that it doesn't know when to use one intonation or another because it doesn't understand what it's saying. Let's say you've got a story where a little boy comes home and asks his mother what's for dinner. What you want the machine to say is something like this.
What are we having for dinner, mother?
But suppose the same sentence pops up in a story about two cannibals who are wondering who their next meal will be. Now you want the program to read it differently, like this.
What are we having for dinner, mother?
Of course, the program can only make this distinction if it has outside prompting. But then, why should we expect a computer to understand what it reads any better than a typical TV newscaster does? Of course, the real problem with systems like this one is the voice itself. They sound inhuman. On the other hand, I'm not sure that we want a computer to sound too lifelike. It's not troubling to see a computer putting written words onto the screen. Writing is impersonal and quite literally disembodied. It requires only a mind somewhere. But the human voice is intimately connected to its physical circumstances. You can tell from somebody's voice if they're tired or hungry or in pain, even if the sensation has nothing physically to do with the vocal cords. That's why computers can never have authentic human voices, because they can't know what it's like to live in the soft, damp speaker housings that we walk around in all day. So maybe it's a good idea to keep them sounding a little mechanical. It will help to remind us that when they act up, they're not really feeling cranky or excitable, or even paranoid like Hal. They're just suffering from hyperactivity in their little silicon glands.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with veteran soul singer Irma Thomas. She's been called the soul queen of New Orleans, and her new record, The Way I Feel, proves she's not ready to give up that title. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review two new albums, Out of Order by Rod Stewart and Other Roads from Boz Scaggs. Ken says both of these rockers have benefited from new collaborations. And guest film critic Michael Schrago will take a look at Crocodile Dundee 2, starring Paul Hogan. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.